Aquí pensaban seguir ganando el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al pueblo a sufrir y seguir de modo cruel contra el pueblo conspirando para seguirlo explotando. Y en eso llegó Fidel y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Aquí pensaban seguir tragando y tragando tierra, sin sospechar que en la sierra se alumbraba el porvenir. Y seguir de modo cruel la costumbre del delito, hacer de Cuba un garito, y en eso llegó Fidel. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.
That's Carlos Puebla and his troubadours with Y en eso llegó Fidel, meaning, and then came Fidel. He's telling in this song, and he was a well-known patriotic singer in Cuba, he's telling the story about the craziness that was going on in Cuba, how the country had been transformed into a casino. The wealthy were extracting 100% profits and didn't have a care about those who were suffering. And then came Fidel, and he put a stop to all of this. So it's a very interesting song. And I thought also, since he has also passed away, it was fitting to play that song today. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. The death, November 25th, of Fidel Castro, the revolutionary former president of Cuba, has further winnowed the already sparse ranks of leaders who were the vanguard of resistance to global imperialism and colonialism. Many of the new generation of leaders thought it futile to stand up to world powers or eagerly traded wholesale pillaging of their people and their nation's resources for private and personal gain. Castro, in the long haul, was both inspiration and help to other struggling nations trying to throw off the yoke of foreign domination and oppression, and a reviled thorn in the side of countries, particularly the United States, that were determined to bring Cuba to heel through blockades, sanctions, military threats, including nuclear war and attempted invasions and assassinations. Castro and Cuba survived. President Obama's announcement in 2014 that the U.S. will seek normalization of relations with Cuba after 50 years was a sign that the superpower was no match for Cuba's determination about its sovereignty. Castro's death, therefore, marks a milestone not only in Cuba's evolution as a nation, but also in global movements against hegemony, especially the hegemony of the West. Historian and political scientist Dr. Gerald Horn discusses with us today this development, this most recent development, the vital role that Castro, Cuba, and the revolution have played and might still continue to play in global struggles against colonialism and imperialism. Dr. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And he's a prolific author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on the struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. He's here always on Lead Stories to help us decode complex social, political, and economic issues, and this is now one of them. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we know that President Castro died on the 25th. He was cremated on the 26th. Today and tomorrow, the nation pays tribute to him, including many reaffirming in writing their dedication to the revolution. And then he will be, his ashes will proceed just using the opposite route, actually, from Havana to Santiago, where he was born and where he went to school. And there his remains will be interred. But in the meantime, what do you see as the immediate reaction, and what does it hint as to what's to come?
Well, first of all, let's note the legacy of Fidel Castro and the socialist regime that he built in Cuba post-1959. I think in the first place, on this side of the Atlantic, we should mention his role in terms of sending Cuban troops to Southern Africa to help safeguard Angolan independence in 1975 against an invasion from apartheid South Africa, which led directly to the independence of neighboring Namibia in the spring of 1990 and the ultimate independence of South Africa itself in the spring of 1994. It's no accident that when Mr. Castro came to the inauguration of Nelson Mandela in South Africa in 1994, he received the most stormy ovation because, as any school child in the region could tell you, but for Cuban troops, it's difficult to imagine how South Africa and Southern Africa as a whole would have been liberated. In fact, I'm doing a book now in Southern Africa, and I was doing research at the Gerald Ford Presidential Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and, of course, came across these memoranda from his top assistant, Henry Kissinger, in the summer of 1975, fretting that Cuban troops would have a legal basis if they wanted to march into Rhodesia, then Zimbabwe, and overthrow that minority regime. And there was even concern that Cuba would then march on to Pretoria and oust forcibly that illegal regime. Now, that did not happen, but certainly it made those white minority regimes more susceptible to sweet reason when it came time to negotiate, knowing that the Cuban hammer wielded by Fidel Castro was hanging over their heads. Secondly, I would say it's the training of medical personnel. That is to say, not only medical personnel from the Caribbean and Latin America and Africa being trained in Cuba, but then Cuba sending its own medical personnel to those particular regions. And then finally, I would say the confrontation with U.S. imperialism, the fact that there were over 630 attempts by the U.S. authorities to kill Fidel Castro, and yet he outlived all of these U.S. presidents. And what's even more interesting, of course, is the fact that this was no accident that he lived to be the age of 90 in the face of assassination attempts. This is a testament to the success and the skill of Cuban security forces, who have then gone on to train security forces in other countries, keeping their leaders alive, given the fact that black leadership oftentimes has fallen victim to the assassin's bullet. This is a particular skill that we would like to draw upon, which brings me to my final point in this litany, which is Cuba as a safe house, as a rear base for people like Assata Shakur, who is still enjoying the hospitality of the Cuban government, or over the years, Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party, or Robert F. Williams, who went on the lam from North Carolina after a confrontation with the authorities and wound up in Havana helping to set up Radio Free Dixie, which then broadcast radio broadcast back into Black America. I think that this is all part of the legacy of Fidel Castro, and that's why we are marking this very sad and solemn occasion that the talks of his passing.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, I live in South Florida, which is to say the largest collection in the United States of Cubans who either were self-exiled or said they were exiles from the country. And the stories, the news organizations have not yet finished reporting the jubilation around the death of Fidel Castro. People are in the streets, they're jumping up and down, they're very, very happy. But a curious thing, as the cameras pan the revelers in the streets, one would be hard-pressed, in fact, I couldn't see but one black face among them. And I saw stories similarly in reports coming in from New Jersey and other places with significant Cuban populations. And it's the same thing. The jubilation largely is among what you would call white Cubans. You don't see any black Cubans among them. I found that odd. Do you find that odd?
Well, no. I mean, I think that the United States has a very naive, romanticized view about revolutionary or even counter-revolutionary processes. That is to say, if you look at the history of the country known as the United States of America, and if you look at its revolt against British rule in 1776, there were winners and losers. We know that many of the losers were, in fact, British subjects who then migrated to Nova Scotia and to Quebec and even to Ontario. Oftentimes their property was taken. There were losers in terms of enslaved Africans who had the chains of slavery fastened more tightly. But of course, the way history is taught in the United States, you would think that the revolt against British rule was supported by all, even supported by all Europeans, which was just not the case. As a matter of fact, if you were to crunch the numbers, you'd probably come to the conclusion that the revolt was spearheaded by a militant minority, particularly a militant minority of slaveholders led by Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and James Madison, assisted by lawyers of slaveholders like John Adams. So if you adopt that framework and that perspective, then you'll understand that after January 1, 1959, you had Jim Crow, U.S.-style apartheid, declared illegal in Cuba, particularly on the beaches, at a time when Jim Crow was the law of the land here in North America. That upset and infuriated many people who fled to southern Florida. And then, of course, the property of some of these folks was taken in any case and turned into daycare centers and nursing homes for the elderly, et cetera. Just like those who wound up being Canadians in 1776, oftentimes their property was taken too, except that it wasn't for necessarily a benign purpose, such as daycare centers and nursing homes. So revolutionary and counter-revolutionary processes have winners and losers, and I think that disproportionately and significantly, the black population of Cuba were winners after January 1st, 1959. And you should also know that there has long been a close connection between Cuba and the United States. This is something I talk about at length in my book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba, during yes. slavery and Jim Crow. That is to say that as early as the 1790s, U.S. nationals were masterminding the slave trade to Cuba. One of the reasons you have so many black people in Cuba is precisely because of the manic energy of U.S. slave traders, particularly sailing up the Congo River and in the Congo River Basin, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight and dragging them across the Atlantic. This is one of the reasons why the leading U.S. abolitionists, such as Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney, wrote and spoke at length about Cuba. In fact, Martin Delaney wrote a novel where he, in a very portentous manner, suggested that Cuba would be the hope of the hemisphere. And I think the 20th century proved him to be correct. We also know that in the late part of the 19th century, the great Cuban hero, Antonio Maceo, who was of African descent, was also lionized here in North America. In fact, the name Maceo, as in Maceo Parker, James Brown's former sideman, Maceo was a common name given to black male babies. And it's also striking to note that after the United States knocks out Spain in the 1890s and then takes over Cuba, that they had to deploy, the United States had deployed many black American soldiers, many of whose descendants remain on the island. But what's striking is that throughout the era of U.S. domination in Cuba, particularly in the 19th century, there was this idea of trying to prevent Africanization, a word that unfortunately has disappeared from our vocabulary. This was the idea that if these slave traders kept bringing Africans to the island, and of course they continued to do so virtually up until the 1880s, then there would be a demographic imbalance which could lead to another Haiti in Cuba. That was the great fear. And so that led directly to the father of Fidel Castro, who was from Galicia in Spain, migrating to the island in the 1890s as part of this effort to whiten the island under U.S. hegemony. But as we all know, that didn't work out very well since Fidel Castro then went on to topple U.S. hegemony in 1959.
Well, this is a very interesting part. I was going to bring in the book, your book, Race to Revolution, here. But here you have a young man, Fidel Castro, growing up in quite comfortable circumstances, father a planter, sugarcane planter, and making money. He goes to better schools and so forth. What was his racial orientation, do you think, at the time that he's growing up? And how odd was it, in your view, that he would do a 360 here and become not just casually aware of the role of race, but he was quite immersed in it and determined to do something about it, even though he came from a privileged class?
Well, first of all, I think you have to understand the way that U.S. nationals, particularly Euro-Americans, routinely treated Cubans. I mean, if you think about it for more than a nanosecond, think about the fact that you had evolved in the United States the so-called one-drop rule. That is to say that metaphorically, one drop of African blood means you're black, even if you look like George W. Bush, for example. It was the idea of blackness as a pollutant, so to speak. And that kind of framework was then transferred entire countries. And so that Cubans, given the fact there was so much so-called, quote, race mixing, unquote, in Cuba, the whole country was seen as suspect. And from early on, in terms of this U.S.-Cuba relation going back to the late 1790s and early 1800s, Cubans were viewed as not quite white as a group, as a whole. And this caused them a lot of conflict in the United States. And this is the kind of system under which Fidel Castro came to maturity after being born on the island circa 1926, circa 1927. So given that context, his ultimate orientation should not be seen to be that shocking or surprising, nor should it be seen shocking and surprising that he got involved early on in the politics of the Dominican Republic, a nation which, as you know, has a kind of color obsession and a color fixation all of its own. And he also got involved in the politics of Colombia on the northern coast of South America. And in fact, happened to be in Colombia, if memory serves correctly, in 1948, when you had La Violencia, the violence, this massive bloodletting, bloodshed in that South American nation. And it's also notable to mention that Cuba is a close neighbor of Haiti. And revolutionary Haiti is a role model, as you know, for many of us in the hemisphere. And certainly many of us many who resided on the island of Cuba. So given all of that, I don't think that you should find it that surprising that this is the way the Fidel Castro evolved. And, of course, one of his closest comrades, who only died a few years ago, was Juan Almeida, who was, of course, one of the leaders of the post-1959 revolutionary processes with Cuba and with Fidel in the mountains, post-1953, post-1956. And so Mr. Almeida, of course, was of African descent. So this is the context in which to explain and respond to the question you just posed.
How does Fidel Castro come to find himself in the vortex of this combination of race, class, and ideology?
Well, keep in mind that Fidel Castro was a founder of the July 26th movement, and that at the time of the July 26th movement being founded in the 1950s, there was a Cuban Communist Party, which historically had had black leadership. In fact, one of the points in my book is that the United States was so fixated and obsessed with the Cuban Communist Party, which they viewed through the lens of trying to understand, say, Paul Robeson, for example, who was a black man who also had a similar socialist orientation, that their guns, at least figuratively, were mostly targeting the Cuban Communist Party. And for a while, as you know, the United States took a rather naive, in retrospect, line towards the July 26th movement. Then, of course, after 1959, there was a merger between the July 26th movement and the old Cuban Communist Party. And I think it's fair to say, as Fidel Castro himself has mentioned, that even before the founding of the July 26th movement, he had been, by his own admission, flirting with ideas of Marxism and socialism. I think it's fair to say, and this is something that should not be discounted or downplayed in terms of Fidel Castro's life, is that his party, of course, recognized the central importance of the Russian Revolution in November, October 1917 as being perhaps the central event of the 20th century, just like the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, was the central event perhaps for this hemisphere, helping to ignite a general crisis of the entire slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse. And with the triumph of the Russian Revolution, this leads directly to the Chinese Revolution and leads directly to the Cuban Revolution. And of course, as we speak, as people in the United States are trying to grapple with the Donald J. Trump phenomenon, which in my estimation represents a counter-revolutionary neo-fascist force, but at the same time marks an accelerated and precipitous decline of U.S. imperialism, that in many ways that too can be traced back to October, November 1917, in the sense that it's the Russian Revolution, which then provided aid to the Chinese Revolution, which now is in the passing lane, in the pole position. And assuming that the Cuban Revolution survives, which I think it will, I think it'll have a lot to do with the fact of assistance from the Chinese Communist Party and from China itself. And in fact, that's one of the reasons, which the press has not told its audience in the United States, why Mr. Obama moved to normalize relations with Cuba. It wasn't just a benevolent act on Mr. Obama's part, nor was it simply just another gold rush, which of course many feel that it might turn out to be, but it was also geostrategic in the sense that the United States is very much concerned about Chinese encroachments in the hemisphere. There was a fear that if China got a firm, unchallenged foothold on the island, that you could have a replay of the October 1962 so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, particularly with the Chinese investment flooding not only into Cuba but into Bahamas and to the Caribbean, et cetera. And so Mr. Obama decided that the better part of wisdom was to normalize with Cuba. Now, of course, Mr. Trump has said that he will reverse that, but if he does, he'll just be biting off his nose to spite his face.
One of the things, I want to go back to the point you made about that was further explained in your book, Grace the Revolution. And that is the universality of struggle, although it's located at this point in Cuba. But I'm looking at how it galvanized the black world. You had African Americans, you had people from the Caribbean, throughout the Caribbean, you had throughout the African continent itself, and you had pockets of Africans dispersed all over in Mexico, Colombia, and other places. Looking at this revolution occurring in Cuba and getting some interesting ideas, but at the same time, they were very meaningfully involved. How did this happen?
Well, it happened, I think, through solidarity. I mean, keep in mind that when you had the events in Grenada, 1979 to 1983, with the New Jewel movement helping to overthrow the despotic regime of Eric Garry, that Maurice Bishop, the then charismatic leader of the Grenadian Revolution, found a soulmate, so to speak, in Fidel Castro. And as Maurice Bishop said in remarks at Hunter College in New York some decades ago on a visit to the United States, there was an immediate resonance between the Grenadian Revolution and the population here in North America, not least because of the large population in North America of descendants of English speakers from the Caribbean, such as Grenadians and Jamaicans and Trinidadians. Speaking of which, of course, there was solidarity between Cuba and its neighbor Jamaica, particularly under the leadership of Michael Manley of the People's National Party, the PNP of Jamaica. This was at a time when the PNP and Mr. Manley himself were under fire from the U.S. administration. And, of course, it was the Cubans who supplied medics and doctors and other kinds of aid to the Jamaican regime. And likewise, after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, some of the most efficient and skilled aid to the Haitians came from their neighbors in Cuba. If you're trying to understand the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and the rise of Hugo Chavez, you recall, of course, that he relied very heavily upon the counsel of Fidel Castro. Recall, in particular, at the time when there was this attempted coup against Hugo Chavez, one of the things that helped to forestall that coup was the fact that Chavez was on the phone constantly with Fidel, plotting strategy to reverse the coup plotters and the coup makers. I mean, you could go on throughout the hemisphere and talk about the solidarity between the Cuban Revolution and these movements and governments in the hemisphere. And, of course, we've already made reference to Haiti. Now, of course, made reference to Southern Africa. But we should also mention the question of Algeria. The Algerian revolution, circa 1954 to 1962 independence, that was one of the first African liberation struggles that the Cubans got involved in. And this was a very bitter struggle. I mean, keep in mind that in some ways, the settlers who revolted in Algeria in the late 1950s and early 1960s against the prospect of Algerian independence, in some ways were like the settlers who revolted against the prospect of abolition in North America in 1776. You might recall that they actually intended to assassinate the preeminent French leader, Charles de Gaulle. The Cubans helped to supply intelligence to the National Liberation Front of Algeria and medical care and solidarity and all the rest, helping to make sure that Algeria came safely to independence. And, of course, I'm sure you recall all the black Americans who wound up in Havana. I've already mentioned Assata Shakur and Robert F. Williams and Huey P. Newton. We could talk about Stokely Carmichael, eventually Kwame Ture, and the time that he spent in Cuba, and the lessons that he learned in Cuba. And, of course, going to Havana was a necessary stop in the 1970s and 1980s for those of us who considered ourselves to be revolutionary, even those of us who considered ourselves to be progressive. So we all have an enormous debt of gratitude to pay to Fidel Castro personally and the Cuban Revolution generally.
I want to ask you, from your perspective as a historian, what would you say, apart from these things that you have enumerated, what would you select as the most incredible contribution of Fidel Castro?
Well, certainly, you know, you have to go back to Southern Africa, because apartheid South Africa, as you know, was wreaking havoc throughout the region. It was propping up the Ian Smith regime in Rhodesia. It was propping up colonialism in Mozambique and in Angola, occupying Namibia illegally, thumbing its nose in the international community. In the process, it was backed covertly and overtly by the United States and its North Atlantic allies. It was a very powerful force. And when Fidel Castro and the Cuban Communist Party decided to intervene in that part of the world overtly in the 1970s, it was not easy because many people felt that it was threatening the detente between Moscow and Washington. And in fact, part of the bill of indictment that was eventually laid at the doorstep of Moscow that led eventually to enormous pressure being placed on the Soviet Union was this idea that supposedly Moscow had violated the rules of detente by not stopping Fidel Castro from intervening in Southern Africa. Now, of course, Moscow argued correctly that Fidel Castro was not some sort of puppet of Moscow, although that was the idea that captivated minds in Washington. What's striking about that is that during the time that the Soviet Union was in existence up until December 25th, 1991, we'll be marking the 25th anniversary of the collapse just in a few weeks, the idea was is that Castro and Cuba were Moscow puppets. Then after the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cuban Communist Party did not follow that path into liquidation, then there was the complaint in Washington that the Cubans and Castro were not puppets of Moscow, since they did not follow Moscow along the path to liquidation. So I would say that leads me to my second point, which is that being able to survive after the collapse of its major patron, that is to say the Soviet Union, post-1991 during the so-called special period, and continuing to survive is something of a feat. And what's interesting is that the Cubans and Castro personally had to reverse feel, because recall that part of the crisis of U.S. imperialism, in a sense, is a self-inflicted wound. That is to say that there was this entente that was brokered with China under Richard M. Nixon in the early 1970s that led to inward direct foreign investment from the United States to China, and the United States foresaw China as this cheap labor citadel and stronghold forevermore, but things have not turned out that way. And keep in mind that when that process was unfolding, one of the bitterest critics of that Chinese policy was Fidel Castro. Go back and look at the speech, I believe it was 1979, that he made at the Non-Aligned Meeting movement that took place in Havana. It was a bitter attack on the policies of the Chinese Communist Party, but then, of course, times change, people evolve, and with the Soviet Union collapsing, now China is in the crosshairs, and Cuba, of course, now is one of the closest allies of China. And what's interesting, too, I should add, to connect the dots further, is that this rise of China has put such enormous pressure on U.S. imperialism, particularly since the U.S. ruling class felt that globalization would mean U.S. hegemony and domination forevermore, but it didn't turn out that way. China, in many ways, has been the ultimate victor of this process known euphemistically as globalization. And this, in many ways, will be seen by historians as one of the reasons why you had this uprising at the ballot box by white working class and white middle class forces who put Donald J. Trump into office, which I think is a dangerous turn of events. And by the way, I think that some of our left-wing friends who are downplaying the backwardness of this vote on November 8th, 2016, in the United States are doing themselves, and particularly ourselves, a disservice, trying to suggest that it was all driven by economic woe is a bridge too far, particularly when one considers that over 60 million people voted for Donald J. Trump. We all know we can't necessarily trust the polls since they had Hillary Clinton winning. So all we can say is that 60 million plus people voted for a confessed sexual predator, a man who exhibits xenophobia and racism and misogyny. And speculating and trying to let off the hook all these white folks who voted for Donald J. Trump, I think, is trying to lull some of us into a false sense of security, which could ultimately backfire even against those who are making these utterly ridiculous claims. Speaking of utterly ridiculous claims, this is this other idea by these born-again economic determinists, because supposedly it's economics that explains the vote for Donald J. Trump, not racism, not xenophobia, not misogyny. The other claim, which actually turns that previous claim on its head, is that it's identity politics. By identity politics, they don't mean Zionism. That is to say, an identity, political identity based on an ethno-religious exclusivism. They don't mean white supremacy. I guess they mean Black Lives Matter. But of course, they're very non-specific when it comes to defining this nebulous term. But somehow, because of identity politics, this meant that there was revulsion on the part of the white masses, once again letting them off the hook, and therefore they voted for Donald J. Trump. It seems to me if we keep up with this nonsensical way of thinking, we'll be one step closer to internment camps. But once again, I think that Fidel Castro and the Cuban Communist Party provide an example of how one has to do a concrete analysis of a concrete situation, not shying away from difficult conclusions, not coming to the analysis of the mythical French intellectual who says, I know what you're saying is true in practice. The question is it true in theory? That is to say, not being locked into some sort of theoretical frame, such as the 1% versus the 99%, without recognizing that historically into this settler colony that's become U.S. imperialism, a good deal of the 99% have tried to become part of the 1%, and of course side with the 1%, which is what they did on November 8th, 2016.
A point of clarification here. Some people say that Fidel Castro played both sides of an ideological game between communism and socialism. Does this have any merit in your view?
Well, I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I was just looking at the
website. I don't know what it means either, but they say, well, is he a communist or is he a socialist? I'm wondering whether you have been able to figure out, A, what does that mean, or what might be the distinguishing characteristics of each?
Well, I was just looking at the Web and Guardian of South Africa website, and they had this picture of Fidel Castro where he was making these very disparaging comments about capitalism being gross and inhumane. Perhaps with this distinction between socialism and capitalism, people are making what may be a valid distinction between socialism being a first stage of capitalism, at least theoretically, and that communist parties, such as the Communist Party of Cuba, try to lay the foundations for the construction of socialism and ultimately evolving into a true communist state, which is yet to evolve, because we all know that even theoretically under socialism, inequality continues to persist. And certainly there are inequalities in Cuba, which should not go unmentioned, not only economic inequalities, but of course, by their own admission, the Cuban Communist Party has had some difficulty in dealing with the legacy of slavery and the legacy of white supremacy. That is to say, it's one thing, as the Cubans did, which is to try to say that there will be no more Jim Crow laws, no more Jim Crow laws on beaches, for example, which was the hallmark of pre-1959 Cuba. But it's quite another thing to try to forge a certain kind of racial equality. Now, people in the United States should have a certain kind of humility with regard to that latter process, given the difficulties that this country obviously has faced. And as a matter of fact, since we're talking about socialism, and since we had a reference to the collapse of the Soviet Union, this may be an opportunity to mention the collapse of formerly socialist Yugoslavia. Because keep in mind that after the demise of their paramount leader, Joseph Broz Tito, that Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia, descended into chaos with wars between Serbia and Croatia, and pressure on Slovenia, and wars between the Kosovars and Serbia, and all the rest. And of course, these pundits in the United States were saying, well, the problem was is that the socialists in Belgrade, they basically drove racism and ethnic passions underground. They did not confront directly the racism and ethnic passions, and then they erupted after Tito's death. Well, I don't think that that'll happen in Cuba, but what's interesting about the United States is that if you look at the history of the United States and the retreat of U.S.-style apartheid, there was an upsurge from below by the black masses, and there was pressure from the international community and the U.S. ruling elite, particularly from the socialist camp and the National Liberation Forces. And now, especially after this election on November 8th, which an election that was dripping with the xenophobia and racism and misogyny, it's possible to put forward the hypothesis that in the broad middle, perhaps there wasn't a change of opinion. And I think part of the problem with regard to racism and Jim Crow and racial equality, part of the problem in the United States is in the sense what happened is that we made it difficult for people to openly confess, at least many people, to being a white supremacist. I think that's why these people speak in such nebulous terms in the United States about identity politics and things like that that they don't define. Recall that in the 1980s, we were a special interest. That's why Walter Mondale lost in 1984 and Michael Dukakis supposedly lost in 1988. Now we're identity politics. And so because there has been not an honest confrontation with the innards of white supremacy and racism, it's possible to put forth this idea that it continues to rest like a silent infection in the hearts and minds and brains of too many of those who reside in North America defined as white. Now, I think that in Cuba, there have been overt attempts to get to that inner psychosis of white supremacy. I am confident that the Cuban Revolution will survive, but as we look at the United States of America and this torturous course, and how it's about to turn sharply to the right as it goes from neoliberalism to counter-revolution, that's going to be putting enormous pressure on the Cuban Revolution, and it's difficult to say what the ultimate result will be.
Well, the revolution is now in the hands of Raul, his younger brother, Raul Castro, and some people are a little bit uncomfortable that they're very different in personality, but they also are very much the same in terms of the long haul and the long vision. But just the same, the question arises, can Raul bring this revolution or be a solid caretaker of it? And with Fidel gone, and there doesn't seem to be a whole group of people that, you know, can replace him. He's the kind of guy, I'm sure, would need several people to replace him. There is an opportunity here to really accelerate the undermining of the Cuban Revolution. Do you think that's possible, that it will occur?
Well, if it is possible, I don't think it'll be happening in the short term. I mean, Raul Castro has been in power effectively since 2006 and officially since 2008. He'll be stepping down in 2018. He'll be in his late 80s by then. His designated successor is Díaz-Canel. And that's when things might get interesting, because at that point, what's going to happen is that Cuba will be moving to a Chinese-style system. Actually, they've moved to it already. That is to say, where the leaders spend 10 years in office, such as Hu Jintao in China, who was president and head of the party for 10 years and then succeeded by Xi Jinping, who is now president and leader of the party, who will be stepping down presumably after 10 years. And I'm sure that that is meant to guarantee that there's a kind of collective leadership, which obviously is a necessity given the kind of pressure that Cuba will be facing if Donald J. Trump carries forward with this promise to move backward on normalizing. I'm optimistic, as I said, in the short term, that Cuba will be able to resist the pressure from the U.S. authorities. But obviously, with Díaz-Canel coming to power in 2018 and this new leadership, which by definition will be an untested leadership, it's difficult to predict what will happen after 2018.
It's also difficult to predict what changes, if any, Soviets will make or China will make in terms of their relationship with Cuba going forward. Do you see any change in the Soviet Union that would bolster the relationship that they used to have and perhaps keep this going? Or do you see that maybe Russia is moving someplace else? It's going its own different path. It's forging its own space in the world and looking to carve out its own empire.
Well, it's in the interest of both Russia and China to maintain relations on a positive note with Cuba. That is to say, with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, dominated by the United States, moving ever closer to the borders of Russia, and with Donald J. Trump doing his campaign, trying to act as if he's thinking strategically by making nice with Moscow and threatening to turn the screws against China, that means that China also has an interest in terms of maintaining relations on a positive note with Cuba as well. We'll get an early indication of where things are going when we see who comes to this funeral on December 4th, the funeral of Fidel Castro. I would expect that there will be an overrepresentation of African leaders, overrepresentation of Latin American leaders, an underrepresentation of European leaders. And in the latter category, it will be interesting to see who Moscow dispatches, whether Vladimir Putin himself will be coming to Havana. It will also be interesting to see who Beijing dispatches, whether or not Xi Jinping himself comes to this funeral. Certainly, I've noticed that when China has sent high-level delegations to Havana, they made a point pre-November 25th, 2016, of stopping by and paying respects to Fidel Castro. I'm talking about the prime minister, for example, the premier, for example. So you'll get an early demonstration and manifestation of what's to come when you see the lineup for this funeral.
What did Fidel Castro himself identify as his failings?
Well, the party itself, and under Fidel Castro's leadership, were self-critical with regard to dealing with racial inequality within Cuba itself. And I think that, you know, they have a point in that regard. I think when I was talking about my book on Cuba, I even think, Eutrice, you mentioned that, if I'm not mistaken. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But in any case, I think that's one of the major failings of Cuba. And I think it also speaks to the veritable intractability of this issue of racism and white supremacy. Now, they made some strides with regard to fighting male supremacy and fighting male chauvinism, but I think there's work to be done there as well. And as I was speaking on another radio show recently about the recent controversy involving the president of Nigeria. I'm not sure if you heard about this. He was having a press conference with Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, in Berlin. And the wife of President Buhari is now estranged. And she made some rather disparaging comments about his inner circle.
She says she's not sure she would be supporting him in his next
election. Right, exactly. And so Mr. Buhari, as Chancellor Merkel stared icily at him, said that he doesn't pay attention to what she says because she only belongs in the kitchen and his living room or, quote, that other room, unquote. And, of course, that other room then got a hashtag and went viral. And this is the leader of Africa's most powerful economy, Africa's most populous nation. And I would not try to generalize from the personal feelings of President Buhari to general failings of Nigeria or Nigerian men. On the other hand, the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree at the same time, and he is the fruit of Nigeria, so to speak. So, I mean, I think that gives you an idea of the problems that Cuba faces, a small country of 11 to 12 million in a sea, veritably, of white supremacy, in a sea, veritably, of male supremacy. And just like it's difficult to build socialism in one country, it's also difficult to build anti-racism in one country and anti-male supremacy in one country, no matter how well-intentioned the party in power may be, no matter how many of the reins of power are firmly in the grip of the party in power.
Well, when Fidel Castro came to Harlem, in, I believe it was 99, he spoke very proudly about the sacrifices of Cubans in struggles all over the world for freedom, and spoke very proudly about Cubans standing with the people fighting oppression on equal terms, giving everything they could to help, including their lives. He was very proud of that. And I think he felt that that was Cuba's greatest contribution to the world, that it did everything in its power to help those looking for, you know, looking to take full charge of their countries and the resources of their countries. And at the same time, he seemed to indicate a sense of frustration that the changes that he had hoped to make in Cuba weren't made fast enough or were thorough enough to get the revolution moving along at a faster pace. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. Once again, we're talking about a country of 12 million. Once again, we're talking about a country of 12 million whose closest neighbor is the most powerful imperialist force on planet Earth, which for most of the decades of the Cuban Revolution's existence has had very bad relations with the United States of America. I mean, my analogy is to the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. Recall that the United States did not recognize Haiti until 1862, that is to say 58 years after the triumph of the revolution. It took approximately 55 years for the United States to recognize Cuba under President Obama, although that may be soon reversed. And if you look at the difficulties that Haiti faced in the 19th century in terms of once controlling the whole island of Hispaniola and then the island being split in 1844, leading to years and decades of enmity between the two neighbors, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, an enmity that still exists to this very day, with the Dominican Republic getting the lion's share of the territory. And now, because of the fact that Haiti had the gumption to rebel against slavery, the Dominican Republic now being more developed than Haiti, even though that was not the case for a good deal of the 19th century. And it's very interesting to compare the trajectory of Haiti in the 19th century to the trajectory of Cuba in the 20th century. If you look at it in that context, well, then you have to marvel at the progress that Cuba has made. And I think that if I were to try to come up with a reason for the difference, I would not only point to the aid from the then socialist camp, which helped to make sure that Cuba was able to stand on its own 2 feet, at least from 1959 to 1991. And even today, as noted, there is something of a relationship between Moscow and Havana. But I would also point to the fact that in Cuba, unlike in Haiti, a political party developed that was able to seize forcefully the reins of power and to execute a plan that has proven to be successful to the extent that the revolution has not been toppled. And to the extent that if you look at objective indices such as years of education, such as life expectancy, such as an ability to thwart malnutrition, such as an ability to thwart homelessness, then you'll see that in some ways it has been nothing less than miraculous that Cuba has been able to accomplish all that it has done in the face of this fierce and unremitting and unrelenting opposition from the so-called Colossus of the North, which, by the way, is in the process, I'm afraid, of being involved in a kind of spiral of devolution, with Donald J. Trump ultimately to be regarded as the Mikhail Gorbachev of the United States of America, a man selected and elected to help to restore what was thought to be the essence of U.S. imperialism, but through the law of unintended consequences, not least, will help to unleash changes that will ultimately prove to be debilitating and ultimately prove to accelerate the precipitous decline of U.S. imperialism.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Gerald. It's always an education listening to you and your analysis of things, and it's always spot on, very insightful, and I want to thank you for the time you spent with us today. Certainly, we'll follow up because we'll be watching between now and December 4th for a number of things, and immediately after December 4th, we'll also be watching about how things proceed. What clues are we getting about changes that are to be made? Thanks so much again for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. That brings us to the end of the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Molotovs and Meditations with Vincent Emanuele. You want to stay tuned for that. Leadstories@gmail.com is how you can reach me. And I want to thank you for listening. I hope this was valuable to you. As we take a look at how things are developing over the next few days with Cuba. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company.
Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.